Welcome back to CannaWeek, brought to you by New Frontier Data, where we deliver the week's top headlines in cannabis and hear experts weigh in on the impact these stories are having on our industry. I'm your host, Heather Wickline. Our first guest serves as CEO and president of the Genesis Group, a full-service cannabis consulting firm, and managing partner of Plant Life Company, a full-spectrum cannabis nutrient company. And on top of that, she is also founder and CEO of Minorities for Medical Marijuana. Please welcome Roz McCarthy.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you so much for being here.
Oh, no, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Of course. And our next guest is no stranger to CannaWeek. He leads our amazing research team here at New Frontier Data. Our team actually has produced the most comprehensive estimates for global cannabis demand to date, has refined the archetypes for cannabis consumers, established benchmark forecasts for the industry's sales growth and economic impact, and correctly forecast some of the industry's most disruptive trends. Please welcome back our Chief Knowledge Officer, John Caggia.
It's a pleasure to be back, Heather. Thank you.
Well, it's always a pleasure. Before we get started, Roz, would you give our listeners a quick overview of Minorities for Medical Marijuana and just what you all are doing over there right now? And
absolutely. For those who don't know, Minorities for Medical Marijuana is a 501c3 nonprofit organization. I consider us community-based. I consider us, when you're wanting to look for an organization that's touching people in the community, the actual social equity applicants, the individuals who need to understand more about the plan from a healthcare perspective, that's what we do. We have 27 chapters throughout the country, three international chapters, one in Jamaica and Toronto, as well as in the UK. And basically, our focus is four different pillars and buckets, I call them. And it's social equity, meaning economic development, workforce development, opportunities for individuals of color in the space. Number two would be social justice, looking at policy and looking at how we can, you know, reform some of the old antiquated cannabis laws that are still incarcerating people. And then the third bucket would be health and wellness. We truly believe that if you're going to speak about this plant and talk about just the economic opportunity, you have to have the healthcare benefits and talk about the wellness part of the plant. I think there's a lot of folks in the Black and Brown community who have been so stigmatized by this plant that they're not even open to the wellness and the other opportunities that it offers. And last but not least, we have a policy side. All those three things cannot happen without great policy. You need policy at the state level as well as the federal level to make sure the industry is diverse, equitable, and inclusive.
Wow, you are a busy lady. I guess my only question is, like, when do you sleep?
Listen, I have two kids. One's in college, and one's away with dad. And she's a senior this year, so and a 6-year-old puppy. So I get it in. At least I have a. It's quiet at home, but it's a quite busy schedule.
Well, maybe you'll have to hire your kids to.
Yeah, exactly.
Got more staff.
Well, I did. I hired my daughter for it. She's doing something for us. So no, I'm absolutely with you on that.
Look at that. Perfect.
Yep. Yes.
All right. Well, awesome. Thank you for that. Well, we have a lot to discuss, so we'll dive right in. Our first story is from CNBC last week reported former NBA forward Al Harrington wants to make 100 Black individuals millionaires through the cannabis business. So we've been seeing the shift in public opinion on cannabis industry as more states begin to legalize, whether it be medical or adult use. And now more than ever, we're seeing a strong demand for more inclusive representation when it comes to ownership stakes in the industry.
Yes.
States like Illinois are mandating social equity provisions in their licensing processes, and brands like Viola, led by Al Harrington, made it their mission to promote representation for minorities in the industry. So, Roz, I'll start with you. How do you view the current state of minority representation in the cannabis industry today?
Well, unfortunately, and one of the main reasons why I got into the industry, I did not have an interest in the industry prior to starting my advocacy role. We are at around about 2-3% in regards to ownership. And that means touching the plant as well as any ancillary businesses. And, you know, there are some brands that are out right now that are successful, that are Black-owned brands, that are Brown-owned brands. And we want to amplify those brands, and we want to figure out how can we either duplicate their success or how do we create partnerships with individuals that live in certain communities who are looking for a mentor to maybe, you know, come underneath their wings, do a partnership. No one's saying that every single, that you know, when you see the Black and Brown businesses that build up, that you have to have all these multiple brands. There's opportunity with the Violas, with the Simply Pures, with the, you know, Mary and Maine. These are all Black-owned brands that are license holders for us to really uplift them, but also create partnerships in these different states. And so the state of what we see right now is that you have almost 80 to 85% ownership, executive board positions are held by white men. And I would say that. And then I would say, you know, and of course we have women who are still having challenges of being in that C-suite as well. So that's the state that we see right now and that we're really trying hard to change.
Yeah, we're very proud here at New Frontier Data to have CEO and founder by a minority woman. So it's really a great company to work at. John, what are your thoughts on that?
Completely agree with everything Ross has said. And, you know, one of the challenges that there's been in, or there's been a couple of challenges, significant challenges in getting minorities to participate in this space. But we really think one of the big ones is the challenges with securing financing, securing capital in this market. So if you look at the industry in its early days, particularly say in the 2012 to 2014 period in the run-up to Colorado's legalization, you know, back then I knew people who were starting the first dispensaries with a jar of cannabis and $5,000. Like the barriers to participation were very low. It was still very much a Wild West type of environment. But it wasn't particularly capital intensive. You know, you just needed to be really enterprising, have a high risk tolerance, and the ability to come in. Now contrast that with the period that we're in now, where, you know, you're scarcely going to see a dispensary being started for less than $1 million. Like the capital requirements to get into this space, the regulatory costs, the legal and compliance costs have gone up dramatically. And on top of that, you've got everything associated with building effective products, building effective brands. And so in a sector where you don't have access to conventional financing options, you can't walk into a bank, you can't walk into most banks and get a loan to start a cannabis business. It means that almost the entire industry is being funded by private capital. And when you look at the income disparity between white earners and minority earners in the US, this creates a dramatic and very, very consequential barrier to participation in the space. Because it means, as we so often see across the economy, people tend to lend money to people who look like themselves. And in this case, it's meant that very affluent white men have ended up investing in a lot of other white men in the industry. It creates an opportunity. It certainly, you know, means that if we are going to make sure that there's equitable capitalization of this opportunity, that, you know, there's more opportunities to get minorities with good ideas funded by the large pool of capital that's looking for space. I think we need to rethink how we frame what a good opportunity looks like in cannabis. Some of that is through forums and platforms which provide opportunities for those engagements and conversations to happen. But also, I think there's an opportunity for a much broader discussion in the industry about the value of diversity as a competitive and business advantage. And I think that's an aspect of this conversation that is still in its infancy and is one whose urgency is growing dramatically as this industry expands.
No, I mean, your point is so well taken, because we had a conversation with one of my members a couple of days ago, and we're looking at the proliferation of, there's a lot of mergers and acquisitions going on right now. And we're seeing there's some companies that are taking loss in order to sell off. You know, they acquired a company 2 years ago. They see now that, you know, that for whatever reason, they want to sell off, you know, that company, and they're willing to take that loss. Well, the thing about it is that, and we have to all understand is that when they bought that company, you know, there were either investors or there might have been stock exchange or whatever the case may be, but someone put money in, or at some point in time, there was flow of capital that was coming into that opportunity. And we don't understand from the Black and Brown community how investors will invest millions of dollars into an opportunity with just as much risk as what we have. However, we only need about $500,000 or $100,000, with the upside being quite a lot bit better. And that palate or that ability to want to take that risk is always kind of like, oh, I'm not quite sure. And so we're trying to figure out what do we need to do to entertain and build those relationships with those investors, but also how can we look at the brands that are out there that are representing our communities and help them to also get investment capital. And because we have found out in our communities, when one goes and starts going to the top, we try to come back and pull up someone else. And I think that may be the model that L. Harrington is thinking about with Viola, but it's gonna take more than Viola. And we do have to have an in-depth conversation as to how to change this.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Speaking of just how people are entering the market and your advocacy part of your mission, what do you see as your major concerns that you hear from minorities about even entering into the space?
Well, exactly what John said. It's a capital problem, but more so than just a capital problem, it's a mentorship problem. Again, John's point is when we saw the arrival of legalized market, especially I use Colorado, it was friends saying, hey, go get your license. I'll teach you what I know. You'll be successful. Then you can teach someone that you know. We as a community were left out of that whole entire ecosystem. One, just because in Colorado, yes, per capita, the amount of Black and Brown people in certain parts of the state, you know, is limited where the resources were. However, we are there, but it was a friend-to-friend type of relationship and a type of opportunity. Now, with the legalized market, we've seen policy people, legislators, who've put in significant barriers into operating an opportunity in that state. And some of those barriers really, in our opinion, are a little lofty. And I think that's why the policy side of what M4MM does, working with organizations like MCBA, is so important, because if we don't set good policy and work with our lawmakers to make sure that if you're going to roll out a new adult use bill in, like, say, Pennsylvania, that you're not going to make it so lofty that individual small businesses, Black and Brown businesses, can't get into the industry.
Can you give a couple of examples of those, like, kind of provisions that are making it so much harder?
Yes. For example, in the state of Florida, where I reside, the first round, you had to have 30 years as a nurseryman. You had to have a bond, a $5 million bond. It's crazy.
Yeah.
Crazy. You had to have a $5 million bond in order just to apply. You had to have X amount of dollars shown in the bank. You know, there's still in the state of Florida, if you can't pass a level 2 federal background check, you can't be employed, you can't touch, you can't own, you can't touch anything with a plant. That federal level 2 background check, that maybe there are some things that you need to do in regards to criminality issues, and we need to have that type of conversation. But for some people, that's really harsh when you're talking about an industry that is by far, we're seeing the biggest workforce trend and hiring trend has been cannabis. However, if you've been, if you've been arrested, incarcerated for cannabis, and it's on your background, and it ends up pushing you to the point where you can't be hired, then you have
in
no
cannabis.
Opportunity.
Yeah, if you're cannabis. Arrested for cannabis, and you can't be hired in cannabis.
I mean, Heather, to be honest with you, Heather, that is a law set by legislators. If we write good policy from the beginning, if we introduce good policy from the beginning, some of these issues and some of these barriers will not be there, and they'll be mitigated where we don't have to deal with them.
That's amazing. Well, I'm happy our listeners can hear that, because I think it's important.
It's important.
John, anything to add there?
Yeah, a couple of things. One, just on this issue of the exclusion of people who have criminal records and specifically cannabis records. And particularly in this moment that we're in, I think that's a really important point to understand how exclusionary that becomes, given the inequitable way in which marijuana laws have been enforced. So the ACLU just put out a report in 2020 showing that Black adults were 3.65 times more likely to be arrested for a cannabis offense than white counterparts, even though they consume cannabis at equivalent rates. In some states, that it was close to as much as 10 times more likely to be arrested for a cannabis offense. Second, there are more Black people in prison in the U.S. than there are white people. So even though the white population is more than 6 times that of the Black population in the general population, the fact that they're almost equivalent numbers of Blacks and whites in prison shows the inequitability in terms of what incarceration has done, and given the roles that drug laws have played in those incarcerations. Has meant, and given that most of those incarcerations are of young men in particular, the workforce that has been the backbone of the unregulated cannabis industry. So when we think about what happens when legalization, it's a lot of people who were in the unregulated market that rushed into the legal side of the industry. The difference between Black and white is that a lot of the white people had not been arrested or did not have records for their activities, so they were able to transition seamlessly into the legal market. But because of the records requirements in a lot of states that prevented people who had criminal records from participating in legal markets, it meant that the exclusionary effect on young Black men in particular was very, very significant. And these may have been people who had exposure and experience with the unregulated side, but those skills were not being transferred into the legal market. They weren't being given a pathway to parlay those skills into setting the foundation for the legal market. So certainly that has been, I think, one of the big issues that has led to this delta and led to the composition of who participated in the market at the outset. And maybe just a second piece, which I actually think has been one of the fascinating things that we've been watching a slow evolution happening, is the significant generational divide, particularly in the Black community, between older Black Americans and younger Black Americans in their attitudes for cannabis. So it's fascinating to me as you look at, you know, some of the strongest opposition to cannabis legalization has been amongst older, particularly religious Black Americans. Whereas younger Black Americans, young people in general, have very strong levels of support. We think getting more mature Black adults kind of oriented to the therapeutic value, kind of getting them to transition away from the stigma that they've seen, because it is they who have seen their children go to jail, they who have kind of borne this kind of grave concern about the negative social effects, but they've only seen, let's call it, the dark side of cannabis, the aggressive prohibition enforcement, the effect it's had on young Black homes. Getting them to see the potential upsides here, it's going to take a lot of education, but particularly because of the potential therapeutic effects that medical cannabis has for conditions that many in the older Black community experience, I think there's a huge opportunity to present cannabis in an entirely new light. And within that community, start to leverage the resources of that community to fund more minority opportunities in this industry.
It's a great point, and that's exactly why I started M4MM. We are that entity that's at the community base, working with the faith-based organizations. Our community we have trust issues as well. And I felt like if I created something and put a lot of hard work and get the name out there, and I did it specifically Minorities for Medical Marijuana, because I wanted our community to know exactly that it was okay to be for this, to look at this from a therapeutic opportunity. And so in our role is to be that entity out there. And that's why we push people to support us, from resources to, and it's more than just money. There's things that you can do to help us to be able to bridge that gap. It's truly education. So I'm so glad that John brought that point up, because it really fits into what our narrative is and what makes us who we are.
Yeah, it seems like we need more stories coming out like Al Harrington. I'm not sure if you know the background of this, but I watched a video on him, and he said that his grandmother was his inspiration for getting into the cannabis industry in 2011. Mm-hmm. You know, she was 79 years old and she was suffering from glaucoma and had severe eye pain. And he finally convinced her to try cannabis. And hours after her first try, he found her downstairs reading her Bible, which she wasn't able to do for 3 years. And she was crying. And her name is Viola. That's what he named the company after. So I think hearing these stories come out, and then the people and what inspired them, and that educating the older community that it's okay. You know, there is a good side to this. It's not just the dark side. It's not just ruining people's lives.
Absolutely. My son has sickle cell anemia, so I'm a sickle cell mom, and my mom passed away from breast cancer. So that's my own personal medical story as to why I felt like, man, if this was an option when my mom passed away in 2005, I don't know if she would have participated. And think about, and especially with cancer and Alzheimer's and diabetes, it affects our community disproportionately in such a rough way. There's a direct correlation with, you look at COVID-19 and the spotlight that was shared on healthcare equity issues in the Black community. We were dying more frequently. We were contracting the virus more frequently. This is not just the beginning. This has been a healthcare disparity issue in our community for years, for decades. And so now I'm hoping that with the stats that came out of the COVID-19 pandemic, with the information that we already know, I want to go back to the states and say, listen, let's go back and revamp some of the medical programs. Allow us to get more licenses. Allow social equity applicants to go in and get those licenses and put dispensaries and resources in our community that can teach people about CBD and about the therapeutic values of cannabis and with THC and things of that nature that we don't get access to. So it's truly, access is important.
Mm-hmm. Access and education. I know you are obviously a very big part of this social equity movement within the industry, but what would you say are sections that would maybe need improvement or that definitely need improvement?
Well, I think, you know, we've seen the proliferation or the starting point of the social equity program had great intention. It was basically looking at the system and saying, listen, we got to do something to make sure that there is a community of people that have been most harmed by, you know, prohibition, give them an opportunity as well to be in the industry. The thing with any policy, any type of program, you can have a great idea, but if you don't execute, if you don't implement it well, if you don't have buy-in, not only from stakeholders who are putting together the programs, but also for the industry as a whole. And you also have to have something where I call like, you have to have these little shoots that catch when you find out that there's things that you didn't think about, like think about the funding aspect of it. Think about the, you know, the mentoring aspect of it. Think about, you know, just the experience aspect of it. Think about, you know, just how do you partner with other distribution partners to get products on the shelf that social equity brand owners want to be able to participate in. So the intention as well, I think execution is important. I'm really good. I have had the chance to connect with Toy Hutchinson, who is the new czar for Illinois. And she really gets it, in my opinion. And let me just tell you why really briefly. She has put into play brand new policies for her social equity program to make sure that people are, if they are identifying as social equity, that they are who they are, that they're not gonna be susceptible to people fraud and coming around and trying to basically trap them into predatory contracts and things of that nature. She's looking at the number of licenses that she wants to make available for this population. But what she does, which I really appreciate, is she has great ideas, but she won't implement until she sees that the first idea, the first wave of what she wants to do, if what she's wanting to put in place is actually happening. And I think that's so pragmatic in her thinking and the way that she is going through this process. Because if you put a blanket end all be all and not have some type of check and balance, the intention of what you want to do may not be the actuality of what happens.
John, anything that you could add to that as far as areas that are needed for improvement?
I think, you know, Roz's points are very, very well made. And maybe I would just add one example of some of the thinking that needs, or why the implementation of the social equity programs needs to be done with an acute understanding of some of the broader context by which the minority communities have faced exclusion from this industry. So just thinking about the capital resource and capital access challenges that this industry that minorities face trying to find cannabis business. If a jurisdiction, very well-intentioned, is announcing at the time that license applications are being made available, that it is making licenses available to the general public, as well as making available license allocations for a social equity program, many of the people who would be qualifying for these social equity licenses aren't at all oriented to what the possibilities could be. So for the regular participants who are people who are pursuing the licenses kind of on the conventional track, they've already been laying the groundwork. In many cases, they've been laying the groundwork for a while. They've mobilized their investors, they've built their business plans, they're ready to go. So as soon as that license application comes through, they've got their assets mobilized and they're ready to go. The social equity applicants haven't even got their shoes on because it is at that point that they're learning, what is the social equity program? How much money are we going to need? Where are we going to go and raise that capital from? How do you structure a deal like this when you don't have access to conventional funding sources? And then they can, and once they've kind of mobilized all of the intelligence around that, then they can begin the application process. Well, by the time they've acquired a license under that schema, the industry's already off to the races. So they're starting two laps behind, and their ability to compete is greatly diminished because this is such a fast-moving, dynamic space. That it's a sea change that happens within 1 or 2 years. So just in that context, you know, for those participating in shaping the development of these social equity programs, it's really critical to start engaging the target audiences for those programs well in advance of those programs becoming live for participation, so that people, so the community can get oriented, so they can start marshaling the resources. Because they just don't have the conventional routes to access that other stakeholders might. And if part of the utility of these programs is equity, an equal chance to get to the starting line together, the kind of activation of both the regulatory licensing and the social equity licensing without any preamble, without any orientation, I think dramatically undermines the ability to get minority participants into this program on equal footing.
Heather, another thing that M4MM has put together, last year in Missouri, as well as in New Jersey and Chicago and Illinois, we did something called a cannabis business licensing boot camp. And basically we took social equity individuals who would qualify, and even those individuals who may not qualify for social equity, but they were interested in having either a cultivation license or being a processor or having a dispensary or maybe being delivery services. And long story short, we did a really comprehensive, intensive training, basically taking them through the application process and what to expect. And when you go through that process, and also what happens on the other side once you get your permit and you're ready to become an operator. I will tell you, a third of the class realized after the class was over, it was a 2-day, 8 hours for both days, that being a license holder was not really their interest. Their interest was something else, and they thought that it was their interest, and they had an opportunity to learn the ins and outs of developing a team, of understanding, you know, SOPs for a dispensary or for a cultivation operation. And once they realized that wasn't really where their passion was, it was towards something else that could be an ancillary part of the industry, it really helped them to focus. And so John's point about understanding what the opportunity is and understanding if it's the right fit and being ahead of the game, we brought investors in who were looking to say, if you have a team and you're looking to get funded, tell me what you're looking to do now and we'll help you. If we don't fund you, we'll help you figure out how to create that package to go and then and try to find that funding. So it was a really awesome program that we are excited that three people that came through our class out of Missouri ended up getting a license.
That's amazing. It's not even bringing people ahead of the game. It's almost just getting them at the starting line with the same tools that everybody else has. And so they have a fair fighting shot to make it.
It was amazing. It was amazing.
That's amazing. And I think it's great that, you know, you can, I guess you don't know what you don't know. I think you come into the cannabis industry, you think that you want to do all these things. And I think your boot camp probably saved a lot of time for people that didn't know what they wanted. And money. Exactly. Oh my gosh, that's amazing. Well, yeah, we are almost out of time, but you know, before we say goodbye, do you guys have any parting words for our listeners?
I think right now there's an opportunity right now. We're in a moment right now, and we have to you know, acknowledge the protests and acknowledge the systemic racism that's in our country, but there's a systemic racism issue in cannabis, and we have to acknowledge that. Our organization is partnering with other organizations that are servicing our community to just shed light on what we need the industry to do. We have an issue from equality and an equity standpoint when it comes to licensing, but when it comes to executive positions, when it comes to board positions. And what I ask your listeners and your viewers to do, when you're looking at a company and you're looking to do business or you're buying, go check out their website. Go look at the faces that are there. Go look at their board of directors and see who's there. And if you don't see a community if you don't see their entities or their director, that board, looking as if that it represents the community as a whole, we should call them out on that. And so we are calling out the cannabis industry saying, you can do more. You can do more. You can hire more. You can be intentional in your, you know, contracting opportunities with Black and Brown owned brands. You can utilize your influence and your privilege and your resources to help one, the nonprofit organizations to do the work that we do, but also to help the industry, help the smaller social equity driven applicants and operators to help them be successful. And so I think if we really take this as a moment in time that we realize it's bigger than here, as this industry continues to grow, that we can do more in making sure that it's more fair, it's more equitable, and more inclusive.
Thank you for that. John?
I would just add that one of the things I think there needs to be a much greater recognition of and understanding of in this industry is the value of diversity as a driver of both strategic advantage and competitive differentiation. So this is, we noted with some alarm that there was a lot of companies that are male-dominated companies where men were making products for aimed at women in the cannabis industry. We think that there's a huge opportunity to really start to think about the ways in which diversity lends strength, credence, a greater perspective in how to build products and services that serve a truly diverse base of cannabis consumers, both domestically and around the world. And just kind of perspective there, the fact that broadly speaking, cannabis is used at equivalent rates between whites, blacks, and the Latinx community. The fact that cannabis is becoming very quickly a global industry, serving Latin America, Asia, and Africa. If this is a marathon, not a sprint, if the companies that are laying the foundation today are going to be the globally dominant brands in cannabis tomorrow, it's really important to start making this idea of having a really diverse perspective part of your cultural fabric. I think that that's going to serve you well today, not just in terms of capturing the current zeitgeist. We don't want people, you know, color washing their organizations just to be part of a movement. You want to do it because it's the right thing to do and because you see the strategic and business opportunity behind it. But two, I think it's really important to think about it in the context of if you are trying to build a brand that will be able to compete in the emerging global cannabis economy. Having those diverse perspectives that help you navigate the broad social and cultural nuances of this emerging hyper-connected global society. Diversity will be absolutely central to that. And it's not something that you can just bolt onto at the 11th hour when you're under duress. It's something that you have to think about proactively, strategically, and ensure that it is fully integrated in the way you think about and build your business. And the time to do that is now, particularly given the speed with which this industry is evolving around us.
I couldn't say it better. Said.
Yeah, yep. Well said. The time is now. Yep. Well, thank you so much to our guests and listeners for joining us at Canna Week. Please be sure to like and subscribe to the podcast. You can find these stories and more on New Frontier Data's Cannabis Insights Daily. I am your host, Heather Wickline, and I will see you next time. New Frontier Data provides this podcast for entertainment purposes only. Nothing stated in this podcast should be taken as legal or financial advice. Reference to any specific product or entity does not constitute an endorsement or recommendation by the company. The views expressed by guests are their own, and their appearance on the program does not imply an endorsement of them or any entity they represent. Views and opinions expressed by New Frontier Data employees are those of the employees and do not necessarily reflect the view of the company or any of its officials. If you have any questions about this disclaimer, please contact our legal department.